Well, it is very good to see everybody here this morning, especially the visitors that we have. We're very appreciative of your presence, and we do encourage you to fill out a visitor's card and let us know if you have any spiritual needs. We'd love to sit down and have a Bible conversation with you and talk about those gospel things that you need to know. The good news that salvation has been so freely offered to you, to all of us. Now, I was reading an article recently about knowledge and intellectualism. And the writer of this article was wondering specifically, is Christianity anti-intellectual? He quoted Bertrand Russell, who's missing the quote right there. But in Bertrand Russell's quote from this particular article, Bertrand Russell, the famous philosopher, said, "I cannot, to my recollection, remember a single word of praise in the Gospels for intelligence." The writer goes on to say of a more contemporary philosopher, Dan Barker, "The freedom to think for myself was what was so seductive about free thinking and atheism. The Bible says we should bring every thought into captivity unto the obedience of Christ. The Bible says, lean not on your own understanding. The Bible is anti-intellectual. The Bible wants us to be like children. I don't like that. I have a mind. I want to use it. One of the biggest sins is to doubt, according to Christianity. The freedom to think for myself, to be free of the restraints of Christianity or any other religious tradition. The idea that I'm not going to be eternally condemned because I have a question." So in this lesson, we're going to seek to answer these two problems. First of all, is there silence in the Bible when it comes to the intellect? That according to Bertrand Russell, that there's not a word of praise for intelligence. And also, we're going to look at the idea that Christianity asks us, calls us, commands us even, to be intellectually dull. Now, I suppose it's easy for naive people to believe whatever. And I'm not arguing, by the way, I'm not arguing that there aren't naive or ignorant people who claim to be Christians. But to make the claim that Christianity itself, that the Bible itself, that the gospel itself commands us to be anti-intellectual, to shut our brains down and just listen to everything without any scrutiny, to me, I think that's a claim that cannot be made and supported, at least, by the Bible. So we're going to answer these two issues today. Barker, first of all, quotes from 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Let's go there and let's see just exactly what the Bible says in this passage. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, read verses 4 and 5. "For the weapons of our warfare," Paul writes, "are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We're destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we're taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, and we're ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete." Now, obviously, Barker only quotes one part of this passage, doesn't he? Of taking every thought captive. And to him, that sort of mentality is anti-intellectual. That sort of mentality is very limiting. To take every thought captive unto the obedience of Christ. But you know, when I read a passage like this, I don't actually see anti-intellectualism. Rather, the context tells me that the Christian pursuit is in fact a very intellectual pursuit. The whole passage is saying you must build your faith upon reason and logic. And when you're going to argue for Christianity, you don't have to be the one who just leans on, well, that's how I feel. You don't have to be the one who just leans on personal experience or subjectivity. But when you are supporting and arguing for Christianity, you are the one who is building reasonable, logical, intelligent arguments. Because look at what the arguments of Christianity can do. He says, the arguments of Christianity, the thoughts that have been brought captive under the obedience of Christ, those are the very thoughts that can tear down every lofty fortress of human intellect and human wisdom. These are not just, again, just subjective thoughts. I was walking down the road one day and I got struck by lightning and I became a born-again Christian. I saw Jesus in a tortilla. No, this is not what our arguments are based on. He says, when the true Christian is arguing for his faith, his arguments are sound enough and strong enough that he can have an answer for every lofty tower of human intellect. I don't see that as anti-intellectual at all. Really, all Paul is doing is encouraging believers to take their stand in the worldview that they have espoused. And I wonder, don't we all do that? Basically, what Paul is saying is, if you're going to be a Christian, you've got to take every thought captive unto the obedience of Christ. If you're going to be a Christian, you must really, really be a Christian. If you're going to be a Christian, then don't depend on human wisdom to make your arguments. And if you're going to be a Christian, then make sure that you are arguing things from the gospel itself. My wisdom is derived from God. Thus, that is where my defense is going to be made. I've espoused the worldview of Christianity, so I might as well really live it. And I might as well really embrace it and accept it. There is no middle ground after all. You can't claim to be a Christian and then keep one foot in the realm of human wisdom. You can't claim to be a Christian and then claim human wisdom as your ally. And we'll talk about this idea of human wisdom here in a few minutes, by the way. The appeal to objectivity, by the way, is empty. That when the atheist comes along and says he's the free thinker, he's just as bound by his chosen worldview as you and I are. We don't think about that, though, but he is just as bound by his chosen worldview as we are. Dan Barker claims in this article later on that the reason why I chose to be an atheist was because atheism as a philosophy brings me to zero. And from there, I can build my worldview, or I can build my sense of myself, or I can build my intellectual case. And yet, even within that argument, there is a weakness. That if atheism just brings you to a net zero, then anything that you've built beyond that, it's all your choice. You can build whatever you want. You can argue whatever you want, believe whatever you want. So just like anybody else, atheism, or the free-thinking one, that is a chosen worldview. Next, he quotes from Proverbs chapter 3, but again, he only quotes it in part. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 3 and read verses 5 and 6 and see what the context actually says here about knowledge and intelligence. He says, beginning in verse 5, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight." So again, the atheist will take one part of that verse, "lean not on your own understanding," and he'll build his argument based only on that. And yet, again, is that anti-intellectual? When you're appealing to a higher authority, I don't see that as anti-intellectual at all. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do you trust the authorities in your life? Do you trust your teacher? Do you trust your doctor? Do you trust the artisan? Do you trust the person who's working on your house, working on your plumbing, painting the exterior? Do you trust the professional? Do you trust the PhD? He's saying, trust God. Trust God. This verse is actually telling us that we must think critically. This verse is actually calling for intellectual discretion. It is not telling you to be dull. After all, the greatest gains that we make intellectually only come when we're willing to accept our own limitations and learn from a higher authority. Go to chapter 14, verse 12. Of the book of Proverbs, in chapter 14, verse 12, there is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. You're never any closer to true wisdom than when you can humbly embrace instruction from somebody smarter than you. And so the Bible is not telling us to be naive or stupid. The Bible is telling us you have access to the highest intellect and the highest authority. You are not always right about everything. I'm not always right about everything. But God is. Trust in God. Learn from God. And this phrase, lean not on your own understanding. Isn't that the job of every teacher? Isn't it our job as students to not lean on our own understanding? To go into a classroom and to not lean on our own understanding, but be willing to accept the instruction from one whose intellect is higher than ours. Does it ever work when you go into a classroom leaning on your own understanding? Does that ever work? When you go into the classroom and say to the history teacher, actually, no, that's not true. It wasn't that date. It wasn't that battle. It wasn't that person from history. Does it ever work to go into a music class and to pick up a clarinet for the very first time and your clarinet teacher says, well, this is how you're supposed to do it. You say, I don't know, I think you're supposed to blow on the other end. No, in every act of instruction, don't lean on your own understanding. So I don't see what the problem is, and I don't see how a phrase like that is anti-intellectual, when in every other pursuit of ours, we are called by our teachers, by our doctors, by our professionals, to not lean on our own understanding. I've never been someone who's worked on houses before. I've worked on my own house before, and I'm relatively handy. I do most things by myself. But I do wonder for the professional what it must be like to be doing your job and working on some aspect of a house, whether it be painting, plumbing, or whatever, and to have a homeowner looking over your shoulder going, no, not right there. No. Why don't you? No, don't do it like that. No. Here, just let me do it. God is saying don't lean on your own understanding. And you will be wise. And you will be intelligent. And you will be rational. Stop leaning on your own understanding and trust the one who has all wisdom and who has all intelligence. After all, if we're going to claim that we believe in a God who is omniscient, then why not lean on Him? Why not? Why not lean on that one? Jesus tells us to act like children, though. What if I don't want to act like children? What if I don't want to be so naive? What if I don't want to be purposefully immature? What if I don't want to be purposefully and willfully ignorant? Jesus says, act like children, and I don't think that's very intelligent at all. I'm a grown man, after all. I can stroke my chin and think about philosophy in a coffee shop with the best of them. Okay, well, let's address this then. Let's address this idea that Jesus tells us to think and act like children. And specifically, we're going to go to Matthew chapter 18. And notice in Matthew chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus called a child to Himself and set him before them and said in verse 3, truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Go on to chapter 19. Chapter 19 and verse 13. Then some children were brought to him so that he might lay his hands on them and pray, and the disciples rebuked them. But Jesus said, "Let the children alone, and do not hinder them from coming to me, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." Well, one thing that atheists don't point out when they want to quote this and say that Jesus tells us to act like children is that the broader context isn't saying act ignorant, be naive, be immature, be disobedient, be gullible. What is it about children that Jesus calls us to be? Whoever then humbles himself as this little child, whoever then humbles himself. Is it a child's intelligence that Jesus is praising? Or is it a child's humility? There's a lot of other characteristics as well, a lot of other qualities that we need to notice. Not their naivety, not their ignorance. Notice from a couple other passages that God doesn't expect us to act like children in every way. In 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 20, it says, "Brethren, do not be children in your thinking." It's a great response, by the way. If anybody wants to bring out Matthew 18 and say, "Well, Jesus asked us to be dumb like children," pull out 1 Corinthians 14:20 and say, "Actually, no. That's not God's expectation. Don't be children in your thinking, yet in evil be babies, but in your thinking be mature." That's a great passage, isn't it? That's a great passage. We're not supposed to be like children in every way. Children might not know everything, and they don't know everything. If you've been around children for about 30 seconds, you realize they don't know anything. But their curiosity, their love of inquiry, their clear sense of justice, their creativity, those things are to be admired. Think about when you're around children, every question that they ask, "Why is it this way? Who made that? What made that? How did that come about? What is that? What's behind that? What's on top of that? What's behind?" Every single question. And one question is never enough. It's always, "But why? But how?" And again, their sense of justice as well. You can't let... Stuff doesn't slip by children, does it? When it comes to things like that, your children, it's amazing how when you ask them to count things or do addition and subtraction, they'll stare at you like you're talking in Mandarin. But suddenly, if one child gets 19 Cheerios and the other one gets 18 Cheerios, "Oh, now you know how to add. Oh, now you know math. I see." But they'll call you on it. "How come she got that many and I only got this many?" That's a sense of justice right there. Now, it's not a very well-developed sense of justice, obviously, but it is a sense of justice nevertheless. And they'll hold you to things as well. If you say you're going to do something that night, or if you say you're going to do something next year, they'll hold you to it and say, "But you said... You said we were going to. You said we were going to get. But you said..." You know, when Jesus tells us to be like children, to be converted, to become like children, yes, there are elements of being a child that Jesus doesn't expect us to be. Whiny or immature or flighty. But there's a lot of other things about children that we should admire. And there's a lot of other things about children that I think lead us eventually to great intelligence. When atheists decry the supposed lack of praise for intelligence in the Bible, one wonders what they actually mean by that. There is, of course, false intelligence, yes. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And notice that Paul does have some things to say about false intelligence when he says, beginning in verse 20, "Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God. God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. He goes on to say in verse 26, "For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world, and the despised. God has chosen the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are, so that no man should boast before God." 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 20 also speaks of false knowledge, or that which is falsely called knowledge. He says in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 20, "Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you, avoiding worldly and empty chatter and the opposing arguments of what is falsely called knowledge." So there is a kind of fake knowledge out there. And according to Paul, that fake knowledge looks really good. And it is the kind of knowledge that the wise men and the great debaters of this age, the intellectuals of the world, are going to espouse. But it is a false knowledge, nevertheless. And why should we be surprised? Because when one's sense of knowledge is first and foremost guided by their atheistic or secular worldview, should it surprise us that they come to vastly different conclusions about life and reality in this world than we do? But this doesn't mean that God is anti-intellectual. Quite to the contrary, many passages praise true intelligence. There's a word in the Greek, sophia, which means wisdom, full of intelligence and use of knowledge. We don't have time to read all of these passages. Let me give you a few here to ponder. In Matthew 11 and verse 19, "The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they said, Behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax gatherers and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds." And that word there is sophia, wisdom, full of intelligence, use of knowledge. Jesus is extolling knowledge here and intelligence, and that the truly wise person will eventually be vindicated. Other passages in Luke chapter 7, Matthew chapter 12, verse 42, Luke 21, verse 15, all again use this phrase, this word, sophia, for knowledge. But then you have another word here in the Greek about a verbal defense or a reasoned argument. Probably you're thinking 1 Peter 3 and verse 15, and you would be correct. Go to 1 Peter 3 and verse 15. "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." Important point to be made there. Very similar to what we talked about from 2 Corinthians chapter 10, that when Paul asks us to make arguments, to make a defense for what we believe in, he's saying make reasoned arguments, logic, intelligence, that what you have to argue is right. Not just right for you, not just what feels right or what seems right in a subjective way, but it is objectively true. So you have truth on your side. And the person who has truth on his or her side doesn't need to be clever and doesn't need to depend on feelings or subjectivity. You have truth on your side. This is the same kind of reasonable, honest arguing and debating and skepticism that the Bereans had. Their faith was evidence-based in Acts chapter 17, verse 11. They didn't have a fake skepticism. They didn't have a haughty or arrogant skepticism. They didn't have a kind of skepticism that always led down a rabbit hole. They had a healthy skepticism that said, we are going to believe, and there's a willingness to believe when we know for certain that what you're saying is truth. Actual, verifiable, scriptural truth. And the Bereans were praised because of that. They were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica because they tested what the apostles had to say by the standard of Scripture. Paul also reasoned with people in Acts chapter 17 and several passages there. He would go to the synagogues and reason with them from the Scriptures. In Acts chapter 18, verse 4, and Acts chapter 18 and verse 19, the same idea there, where he would reason with people, make logical, reasonable, rational arguments. And I know that Bertrand Russell specifically said not a word in praise of intelligence from the Gospels. But I find it hard to believe that anybody can read through the Bible, get to the book of Proverbs, and not see a book that is in praise of intelligence. I know it's not in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But the very same writer, Solomon, who wrote the book of Proverbs, was complimented by Jesus in the Gospels. You do remember where Jesus said that the Queen of the South, the Queen of Sheba, traveled very, very far to go to Solomon to hear his Sophia, his wisdom. Jesus praised Solomon because of his intelligence. So why would we not include some of the things that were written in the book of Proverbs in praise of the same? Go to Proverbs chapter 8, verse 1. Does not wisdom call and understanding lift up her voice? Does not wisdom call from the Bible? Does not intelligence call to us from the Bible? Chapter 3 and verse 21. My son, let them not depart from your sight. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. Chapter 4 and verse 5. Acquire wisdom, acquire understanding. Don't forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Verse 7, the beginning of wisdom is acquire it, and with all your acquiring, get understanding. Verse 11, I have directed you in the way of wisdom, I have led you in upright paths. Chapter 11 and verse 2, when pride comes, then comes dishonor, but with the humble is wisdom. And maybe that's why Jesus made the connection in Matthew chapter 18 and in Matthew 19 to children. The one who has the heart of a child, who emulates, as Jesus says, the humility of the child, he's the one who really becomes wise. He's the one who becomes intelligent in an intelligence that can't be calibrated by worldly standards. With the humble is wisdom. And you must humble yourself enough to accept that. To accept that you don't know everything. You don't know how to play the clarinet, unless you do, of course. And you don't always know how to fix something in your house. And you certainly don't always know how to diagnose your own health problems. Why don't we lean on God's understanding? Why is it that when we come to a spiritual subject, a spiritual decision, that the atheist has such a hard time accepting the highest authority and the highest intelligence? Let God guide you now. If you're not a Christian, you need to become a Christian. So if you have a spiritual need, then I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.